In this month's episode of the Central Texas Leadership Series, a special conversation of On the Record with NPR Southwest correspondent John Burnett. KWBU board member Maxie Parrish sat down with him to discuss his career in radio, his experiences reporting abroad, and how building relationships is vital to telling a good story in a changing reporting atmosphere. The conversation was recorded on October 25th, 2019, in the KWBU studios.
Well, good morning, and welcome, John Burnett, to Waco.
It's great to be here, Maxie.
It's a very exciting honor to have you here today.
Oh, it's super great to be back in Waco. I started my career here in 1980.
Wow.
So everything goes in a circle.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I worked at the Waco Trib as a Central Texas reporter. It was a wonderful job. There were three reporters just covering Central Texas and one doing agriculture news. It was a big bureau, and they gave me a giant sand-colored Ford LTD with a really cold air conditioner and said, "You've got 12 counties to cover, John. Go and stay out of the office." And it was a great job, just covering Hill County and Freestone and, you know, all these county courthouses.
Wow.
It was a great start.
Wow, that's great. And that was out of going to school at the University of Texas, the journalism program there.
Yeah, it was one of my first jobs coming out of the J School down in UT Austin.
Okay, and you've come a little way since then, around the world dozens and dozens of times. One of your areas that you've really focused on is immigration, both here in the U.S. and in Europe. Where do you see this going? It's been such a issue for so long now. Do you see resolution, or is this just the new normal?
You know, that's a great question, Maxie, and I think it is the new normal. I think we are seeing a historic movement of people across borders all over the world. We tend to live in island America. We're obsessed with our own problems, and we think we're the only ones who are dealing with a humanitarian crisis at the border. And, you know, whose president is hammering on immigration day and night, and yet it's happening all over the developed world, certainly in the European Union. I was just in Spain last month. I was in Germany, in Berlin in December. You know, they have huge problems with Syrians and Afghans and sub-Saharan Africans coming there, and what do they do with them? What constitutes asylum? Do you have demagogue politicians who are going to beat up on immigrants as a way to get votes? You know, how much is legitimate criticism of illegal immigration? And so with climate change, with the disparity in wealth between developing countries and developed countries, I just think immigration is going to be a huge issue for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. We all know how America has reacted to immigration on both the left and the right. It's become a hot button issue for many voters. But how have you seen the reactions in other parts of the world, in particular Europe, which really has really a longer immigration crisis going than we do, and in some ways perhaps even a more serious one? How do you see various countries in Europe reacting to
immigration? You know, it's funny. It's almost analogous to ours, Maxie. You have, you know, conservatives who are sick of immigrants, who are sick of providing for them, of seeing their cities change, of hearing accents and languages that are unfamiliar to them, of seeing people that are different from themselves. And I think in that way, they're very similar to a segment of America that is alarmed by how many immigrants are coming here, and these enclaves, these particularly Spanish-speaking enclaves, but also, you know, Arabic and, you know, Muslim enclaves. And so that's on one side. On the other, I mean, we ran across people in Spain who were distressed that Italy, for instance, was turning back rescue ships full of immigrants who were trying to, you know, come across the Mediterranean, and had actually criminalized the rescue of these ships, these leaky ships full of migrants, in the way that immigrant sympathizers in the U.S. are alarmed at how the Trump administration has, they feel, used cruelty as a deterrent to immigrants. The administration would say we're just delivering consequences. So, you know, the immigration debate is polarized in Europe, just like it is here at home.
Wow. Okay. You've worked in some three dozen countries, perhaps even more if my count's correct. But do any of them stand out for any particular reason? Anyone that's just unique, different, troublesome, fun?
There's so many. Afghanistan is felt as foreign as any place I've been. There are people that have never known peace there. It's been at war between the warlords and the Mujahideen, you know, the Russian occupation, the American involvement, and it's still going on. And it's just this amazing land. It looks, you know, the wildest part of New Mexico reminds me of the Stark Mountains of Afghanistan. And another one is Somalia, where you have the Al-Shabaab, which is a ruthless terrorist group, and it's a failed state, it's a dysfunctional state. The refugee camps are sort of run by these refugee lords who you have to deal with if you want to interview anyone there. As a 6'7" white guy, I had to pay $1,200 a day for my own militia, a gun crew, to protect me when I went out on the streets of Mogadishu to interview people. I was such a kidnap threat.
Wow. I hope you have a good expense account.
Well, it explains why covering the world is expensive and why, you know, if you cover a war, if you cover conflict zones, just the security alone is extraordinarily expensive because we've lost a journalist now.
Yes.
We've lost David Gilkey, a good friend and a beloved incredibly talented journalist, along with the translator. And so NPR News has joined the club of professional news organizations that have lost a journalist doing his job. And so just the security precautions we take both here and overseas are pretty intense.
Yeah. You've actually been embedded with Marine units in addition to working on the front lines of hotbed stories where bullets are flying, not just political conflict, but but real live military conflict. What's it like to work alongside active duty military who are out there doing their job?
Being embedded with a military is an awkward way to cover a conflict. It's not the way they did it in World War II or Vietnam. I take it back. It's not the way they did it in Vietnam, in that we depended on the Marines to feed us, to house us, to protect us, to transport us. And it's an awkward way to cover it because we invariably end up writing things that the Marines don't like.
Right.
And yet we depend on them for our survival and they're not happy with us. And so we that lack of independence. But during the invasion of Iraq, it was a very, very dangerous battlefield, and you kind of wanted to be under the dragon's wing. But aside from that, everything you've heard, they're valiant, they're courageous. They saved my life on a couple of occasions, absolutely.
Wow. Can you tell one of those stories?
Yeah, I was the week after Baghdad fell, the insurgency was just coming around, the Sunni insurgency, and so guys were popping up, and they would call it pray and spray. They'd get a Kalashnikov, and they just kind of rake it back and forth. They were there were no IEDs yet, and it was pretty random and not well aimed. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Wow.
But I was with a Marine unit. We were in a Humvee, which was not armored, and we were driving through Baghdad, and some insurgents opened up on us, and so rather than flee, they stopped in the middle of it and ran out of the Humvee into the fire with their weapons blazing. The turret gunner, who had a 50 caliber on top of the Humvee, was from East Texas.
Wow.
And we had all been talking beforehand, and And so all of a sudden I felt an M16 land in my lap, and he goes, "You're from Texas? Use that thing."
it's an AR. You got to know how to.
Yeah. Needless to say, there would have been a friendly fire incident if I had.
Oh, wow.
Didn't pick it up.
Wow. That's amazing. And I guess another danger there is that these guys are protecting you, but they're also the source of a lot of your information, but you're there to be objective. How do you balance that in that scenario where you thank you for saving my life? Now I got to get the real story.
They're modern troops, and they understand that we've got a job to do,
mm-hmm.
And that you know we're going to write critically at times.
Mm-hmm.
But our briefer was actually General John Kelly. Mm. Who was General Mattis's right-hand man,
mm-hmm.
and he went on to become Trump's chief of staff. And
sure.
General Kelly and I knew each other from the battlefield and liked each other, actually, and so he gave me a big scoop interview in the White House a year ago, May. That was pretty interesting.
Wow. You have done some work with the Poynter Institute. Now, not everybody knows about the Poynter Institute, but those of us in journalism do. I'm a journalism professor, and I've been there.
Yeah.
For a seminar. Tell us a little bit about your work with Poynter. And my reason for asking this question is we live in a country today where many people, at the insistence of, let's just be honest, the president,
mm-hmm.
believe that journalists are unethical, that they don't seek the truth, that they have an agenda.
That we're the enemy of the people.
There you go. There you go. And the Poynter Institute, for those who don't know it, stands for the very opposite of that. So could you tell us a little bit about your work with Poynter?
It stands for excellence in journalism, professionalism, and especially ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And doing journalism the right way and the compassionate way. It's in St. Petersburg, Florida, and it's kind of like a workshop and think tank, mm-hmm. where young journalists go to perfect their craft. And I've done a couple of workshops there over the years. For radio, and you know they have these discussions about what's fair and what's balanced and what's ethical, and how do you cover an administration that wants to demonize the press,
mm-hmm.
and that has its own set of facts, its own narrative, which is
alternative facts,
which is completely at odds with mm-hmm. the facts that we turn up in the field. And I haven't been back in a number of years, but. It's a new world covering the Trump administration, and I know they're talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about journalism today, where it is, where it's going?
Gosh. There's so many things that are going on, Maxie. Papers are struggling. Mm-hmm. Local papers are struggling everywhere. There's almost no two paper towns anymore. I grew up in Dallas. We had the Dallas Times-Herald, Dallas Morning News, great newspaper war.
Mm-hmm.
One of my first jobs in San Antonio, The Light was Hearst. The Express mm-hmm. News was Murdoch. We had a great newspaper war down and dirty. And as papers contract, you know, they're moving online. There's fewer journalists or few journalists doing the hard work, covering the city council, filing freedom of information requests. And yet public radio, you know, this network that we're on is really doing well, and we're growing, and we need people's support. We have NPR has 17 domestic bureaus and 17 foreign bureaus.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with podcasting, it's a new world. NPR used to do long form magazine journalism. You know, I'd do 15-minute stories, and that's all moved on to podcast now. It's mm-hmm. all become kind of meaner and leaner
mm-hmm.
in some ways. It's frustrating to me. Sometimes I think NPR sounds too much like the radio version of CNN, but the information flow has everything is quickened with the 24-hour news cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've changed our sound as well. And the other elephant in the room is that we've just become so divisive. And social media,
mm-hmm.
people are their worst selves. They're screaming at each other on Twitter and being pretty nasty and attacking, and the polarization in politics is absolutely mirrored in the media between the conservative media and the mainstream media. So,
mm-hmm.
Everything is changing.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I just, again, want to welcome John Burnett to Waco. Thank you for being here.
And it's great to be here, Maxine.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, we were discussing kind of the changing state of journalism, and newspapers are struggling. We see other facets of this, conservative networks, more liberal-leaning networks. Where do you see the role of what's commonly called the citizen journalist, the guy with a smartphone who can shoot video and ostensibly have as wide a reach as you mentioned, CNN?
You know, it's amazing how everyone, but with YouTube and with really great smartphones that take amazing video, anyone can be a citizen journalist and can hold the cops accountable and the Border Patrol, because everybody is a potential reporter. And so that's changed our landscape. There's good in that, in that, you know, it's kind of democratized media. Everybody can do their own reporting. But this is what we do is not something that everybody can do. I'm sorry.
Yes.
You might be able to turn on your smartphone and record a police arrest, but then doing the research to find out, you know, what was the record of that officer? How does it fit into the context of, you know, this department's, you know, treatment of people of color? How that fits into the national picture? You know, has the city council acted on that before? There's just so many elements that you have to. You have to do the fact gathering, and you have to do the hard work. And, you know, most citizens are not going to do that. And professional journalists are the ones that do that work. So it's incomplete journalism, although it has its place.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to put it. As a journalism professor, I would hope that we're imparting those higher standards. And, of course, a board member here at KWBU, that is the hallmark of public radio as well, too. Do you see yourself in this landscape as maybe being something of a torchbearer for good journalism?
Everybody who's done it as long as I have. I mean, I've been a journalist for 40 years now. I started in 1979 at the Garland Daily Herald, so Garland Daily News.
Garland Daily News, home of Storm and Norman, the sports editor. I knew him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I covered police and fire and edited the real estate page.
Oh, so, boy.
Yeah, I mean, I am a torchbearer because I think it's good journalism, and fact-based journalism is more important all the time when we have an administration that misstates things so often. We have to check that out. And I tell students all the time down at UT, it can really be a fun profession. Mm-hmm. And don't forget that, that, you know, it can really be adventurous and exciting and wonderful camaraderie in a newsroom. Mm-hmm. It's a great profession. And but you're not going to have enough to support a family, you know, doing your own podcast. It may be a lot of fun. So at some point, you know, you've got to get to a position that can pay you a living wage. Yeah. And that's becoming harder and harder in modern journalism, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Having been around a while and gone from a vibrant local journalism atmosphere to daily news, Waco many years ago had two dailies as well. Is it discouraging to see where things are going, or do you just view it as a challenge?
You know, I don't think the change is discouraging. Change is just going to – just like look at downtown Waco. Everything is changing, and that's the only constant is change itself. Mm-hmm. So I'm not discouraged. I do miss the civility that used to exist in journalism. We've just – you know, we really just pulled apart. You know, there's two worlds of journalism now. And you know, and to tell you the truth, Maxie, I think too many young journalists spend too much time on their screens. I think that the skills you have to learn are developing sources and checking back with them and making face contact and using your personality and your warmth to make people comfortable and get information. And I feel like the digital world, I think, is the tail that's wagging the dog now.
Yeah.
And in journalism also, you can't just sit in front of a tube all day.
Right.
You know, you got to get out in the world and meet people.
What you're talking about is interviewing and reporting, really.
Yeah.
And the good stories come from not what I describe in my classes as the tennis match. Boom, tough question. Boom, tough answer. You know, guys hitting the ball back and forth across.
Yeah, you've got to get out there, and you've got to get the context, and you've got to give color, and you've got to, you know, create characters, and you know, journalism is still storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, if you're going to get people to hang on to it.
Yeah. Have you had a really tough nut to crack in an interview, and finally it came through, and something magical happened?
Oh, I'd say the interview with John Kelly, Trump's chief of staff. He really opened up to me in a way because, you know, we'd known each other in Iraq, and it was an extraordinary interview. It made a lot of news.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was using ours, and it was because of the personal contact. It's not because I put in a request and said NPR wants to interview the chief of staff. It's because I knew him, and you know, those personal contacts are. Those relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, journalism is about relationships. It's not just about facts on a screen.
When you're working, how much are you thinking about your audience and what they consider to be news and how they will perceive your story?
I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about being balanced and having a fair story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the audience wants.
Yeah. Okay. How do you achieve that in today's world, balance, fairness? Because I teach this and I see it eroding. How do you?
You know, sometimes it's one of the hardest things is to, for instance, I cover immigration, to get Customs and Border Protection, to get them into a story in a meaningful way. They rarely will speak on the record now. You might get a statement. Same thing with ICE, with Immigration Customs Enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, and I know that they're overwhelmed with requests for so many people in covering immigration now, and you know they're slammed. But trying to get the administration's point of view in there, when they will go to Fox News and they will give sit down interviews for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
If we get a statement from them, you know, we're lucky. So it's harder to include that balance.
Yeah.
But we do. We absolutely do.
Sure, sure. Journalists are always looking for the next big story. What's the next big story out there? What do you see coming that perhaps the average guy on the street doesn't know yet about?
Oh, my God. Well, I don't think it's any secret. We're wondering who's going to run the government in 13 months. Are they going to double down on immigration and finish, you know, the revolution in immigration that Trump started? And continue if he's, you know, he doesn't have to worry about reelection anymore, you know, he's going to continue his policies. I mean, that's just a huge, huge question. It's all, you know, the other shoe.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everybody is, I think, focused on now, because he has dominated the news completely for the past, you know, 3 years, mm-hmm. 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense that there's a little bit of fatigue setting in?
I think they are. I think people are fatigued of all the Trump coverage. Reporters, you know, I mean, we're based in Washington, so, you know, they're always sipping their own bath water, and it's just all Trump all the time. And I personally get sick of hearing it all, but
sure. He's
the president. He's immensely powerful, and he's breaks the mold, so makes a lot of news.
Mm-hmm. We were talking before we started the conversation here about some of your travels, where you've been, where you're going. Give us a snapshot of what your, let's say, a month at a time is like, where you're thinking ahead, you're planning, you're going, you're packing, you're washing clothes, you're just trying to keep the whole process going.
Well, I travel a lot to the border and wherever the immigration news is. So stories pop up, you know, a week ahead, and I travel a lot, you know, get a lot of air miles, put a lot of miles on my Toyota Highlander, you know, with real jazz on Sirius XM radio, listen to my tunes.
Thank goodness for Sirius.
Exactly.
Got to be careful.
There is just, yeah, there's a lot of logistics, spent a lot of time in hotel rooms, but it's just, it's part of the job.
Yeah.
I love meeting new people. You've got to be curious in this business. And
absolutely.
And I, you know, love going to new places.
Wow. So where do you go from Waco?
Well, I was in the Panhandle last week, earlier this week. And so this is the week of October 21st. So I've got a story that I need to write about immigrants and coming to Moore County. And I got some great interviews, really great voices up there. I mean, given the choice between talking to a equivalent of a county judge in Connecticut and a county judge in the Texas Panhandle, they're just going to be more expressive and more interesting to listen to. So radio is blessed to be in Texas and have all these characters down here.
What an incredibly rich array of cultures and people and accents and everything else that we've got going here.
Yeah, that works well on the radio.
Yeah, of course it does. Something else that works well on the radio is harmonica. I understand you're a world-class harmonica player.
I've played a tune or two.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my other life.
Okay. Who have you played with?
I used to sit in with Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I've played with Asleep at the Wheel, and I play in two bands in Austin right now.
Wow. Okay. I wish I had another hour. So, Stevie Ray Vaughan, of course, the late Stevie Ray Vaughan, many would argue the greatest blues guitarist or perhaps even electric guitarist ever.
Yeah.
What was it like backing him up?
Well, I didn't back him up, but we played together actually. He was trying out guitars. It's kind of a cool story. He was trying out a guitar in Ray Hennig's Heart of Texas Music down in South Lamar in Austin. I was still in college, but I played a lot of harmonica. And I was trying out some new harps, and it was a huge store. And so Stevie was over here trying out a new guitar, and I was, you know, probably 20 yards away on a harmonica, and we started playing the same song.
Oh, wow.
And so we started playing together across the store. And then we were just like jamming kind of sight unseen. And then he walks over to say, "Hey, man, that sounds pretty good. Why don't you come down to the club?" So I went down to the Rome Inn where he was playing with Miss Lou Ann Barton and honked a tune with him.
Wow, a Renaissance man. Well, it's been a joy and a pleasure to talk to you today. And thank you for coming to Waco, and thank you for sitting down with us and sharing your insights on what your career has been like and where journalism is going.
I appreciate the offer, and thanks for what you do for trying to teach young journalists the right way to practice the trade.
Well, thank you so much.
You can find this conversation online at kwbu.org under the Programs tab.